His name is Brian Sonia Wallace. He was chosen out of thousands of applicants from across the country to be writer in residence at the Mall of America last summer. He wrote about his experience earlier this month in The Guardian. Brian decided to make a living writing poetry a few years ago after hearing a story on the radio about a man who had done exactly that. The week-long residency at the Mega Mall was definitely not his first rodeo. He has served as a poet for hire for Dollar Shave Club, Google, Amtrak, and other corporations. Brian is the author of I Sold These Poems, Now I Want Them Back. He joins us on Skype from Los Angeles. Brian, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, at the top of the hour before news, we gave you a prompt to write a poem for us. You had 7 minutes, and we asked you to put together something about good conversation. And we know you have been typing away because when we pulled up Skype, we could hear your typewriter just flying away in the background. So
yes, indeed.
The big reveal. Let's hear it, Brian.
All right, here it goes. Good conversation. Until you can see the whites of their eyes, until you can hear the timbre of their voices, don't talk. Until you can confirm the contents of their thoughts, until you can spill a glass of wine and have it not even matter, until you can have a child together, start a company, dance salsa, don't talk. Unless you're willing to spill yourself, unless bravery has a home in this house, don't even breathe. Unless conversation is as easy as breathing, unless the radio is playing, the TV going in the background, kids screaming, this is America after all, don't worry what you will say next. Dialogue is a form of skydiving. Don't forget who's got your back. You can't do it alone.
Oh my goodness. Brian, this might be the first for WPR, a poem crafted over the top of the hour news. So moving. You are so gifted.
Thank you so much.
So
that's a 6 a.m. poem for me. I've got my coffee in one hand and the typewriter in the other.
Can you tell us about your typewriter? What is your tool, your instrument to put these words down?
Sure. So I have about 5 typewriters that I own myself, and last time we tallied, I think it was 25. It's probably up to 30 now between the members of my poetry group. The one that I always work on, though, my workhorse, my kind of constant companion that's come with me across the country and overseas, is this little teal Olvetti Underwood. It's a Litera 32. It's a very kind of 50s machine, that beautiful sort of off blue color, and it's super light and it breaks less often than some of the other typewriters. The funny thing with typewriters, in the year 2017 is that you can get them, really, really cheaply, but they're very expensive to repair.
And I'm sure getting through security isn't easy as well.
There's always the question of, like, you know, they say take your laptops out of your case. And when I'm flying with a typewriter, I always have to go, what do I do here? they usually open it up beyond the checkpoint and just kind of have a chat about it, which is, you know, all in all, a pleasant experience to have going through airport security.
Absolutely. And so do you decorate the typewriter? Do you make it a focal point when people come up to you and have this intimate conversation? Do they first look at your typewriter and then that is a gateway to conversation?
Absolutely. The typewriter, in a really kind of unexpected way, has become so central to that practice, because if you're sitting in a public space and you're writing on a laptop or writing in a notebook, people leave you alone. Like, that's a very clear signal to people passing by that you don't want to talk to this person. But if you're writing on a typewriter, I think it's the visual, but as much as the visual, it's the noise.
And nice.
Being able to hear that as you're walking past, it's this instant kind of throwback for people's memories. It's this instant call into the past. And so it really gets them to come over. And then I have one typewriter that got so beat up that I ended up painting it. But most of them I try to keep as close to original condition as possible, because people will see them and they'll say, oh, I had one just like that. Or, you know, I typed all my college papers on one of these. Or if they're, you know, under the age of usually like 20, they'll go, where's the backspace key? How do you erase if you've made a mistake?
So set the scene for us. When you go to a public space and you set down your typewriter, before we get to the Mall of America and that whole phenomenon there, you know, what is it like for you to go into a space? Where do you go? How do you set up? You know, what happens?
Oh, man, it is continually nerve-wracking, because everywhere I go, I think we have a there's a constant question about where poetry can live and whether poetry is still something that can live in our lives. And everywhere I go, every time, I'm always like, will this work here? And I've been, I think it's a combination of luck and a commentary on our society that it tends to. So I started in 2014 and really started off busking, which is, you know, the same thing musicians do with guitars on the side of the road. And so I just looked for areas that had stuff going on. So in LA, we have a lot of taco truck festivals.
Mm-hmm.
That's a thing that we do. And those ended up being a really good context when I was first starting out, because a lot of people are coming. They have cash. They're there to get food. They're there to hang out with friends. But there's not necessarily a lot of existing entertainment that you're competing with. So that was really my start. And originally when I started doing this, I thought, okay, like, this is going to be cute for a month. You know, this is going to be really interesting and I'm going to learn a lot. And then a month is going to pass and I'm going to be so over it.
Because you were a grant writer before this.
Right. I was doing grant writing for nonprofits.
Yeah.
And so this, in some ways I was like, okay, cool. I've had some grants that have started as, you know, poems on the backs of napkins, just sort of dreaming, you know, how will the world be better if this program gets funded? And so it, in a sense, it was a way of taking that out to a wider audience. But the really cool thing that happened after that month is I started getting people reaching out to me. So at the beginning, it was mostly smaller things, people who I'd written for on the street who were having a birthday or were having like a company holiday party. And just, you know, I had this interaction with them on the street that meant something that was interesting. And so they would give me a call or send me an email or get in touch in some way and say, hey, you know, would you come to my house? Would you come to this restaurant?
The face painter or the bartender or the balloon sculptor.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
The poet writer.
One of my favorite contexts, I did a, this was in the early days, I did a conference for these investment bankers. And it was me at this like swanky hotel next to the pool, set up next to Cuban cigar rollers. And it was the poet and the Cuban cigar rollers. And that was the... that was the entertainment for the evening.
You know, there's something that could go hand in hand there, I think. I don't know about swanky hotel.
Yeah, this is kind of part of my, I don't know, part of my grand thesis, if I have one, is the idea that poetry can live in any space.
And you can make yourself so accessible in any space, because you've done these poet for hire gigs now, and they're starting to mount up. You've done work for the Google of the world, and you've done work for other big corporations. But how are you making poetry more accessible?
I think that a big part of that, I think about a lot about the idea of showing up where people live or showing up where people already are. And I think that within the arts, in general, across disciplines, we can get into a little bit of a habit of kind of talking to ourselves, talking within our own communities as artists. And so a huge part of it is going back into people's everyday lives. And sometimes that's you know, just writing for all the employees of a company. And sometimes that's coming into different types of spaces that people are not going to for the arts, but kind of giving, I want to call it proof of concept for whatever reason at this hour, but proof of concept that the arts have something to give, that the arts can add value to this space. And I think that's a huge issue really in our national conversation about what the place of culture and the place of creativity is, not just in an office context, not just in a concert context, but kind of across the board in our lives. One of the things that, at the mall in particular, that I thought about a lot and kind of learned in a way is that most malls across the U.S. are really struggling. There's with Amazon.com and all of the online retail, people just don't need to leave their houses anymore. You know, you can stream all of your entertainment on Netflix and you can order everything next day with Amazon Prime and get your groceries. And so even these retail spaces and places that maybe we think of conventionally as quite commercial and soulless are having to figure out, how do you get people out of those, out of their houses? And art spaces are having those same conversations.
We're talking right now with full-time poet Brian Sonia Wallace about his takeaways from being Mall of America's first poet in residence and his work as a full-time poet. He wrote about his experience earlier this month in The Guardian, and he was selected out of thousands of applicants to write poems on the fly for shoppers passing by in the Mega Mall this past June. It was part of the mall's 25th anniversary celebration. We're also learning about Brian's strategies for keeping poetry alive and well in this world we live in, and how a full-time poet is able to land these paid poetry gigs. He's carved out a niche for himself. He's the author of I Sold These Poems, Now I Want Them Back. Bring your questions for Brian at 800-642-1234. How do you use poetry? Does it have a place in your daily life? How do you know whether poetry even matters anymore? Do you write poetry? Join in, 800-642-1234. We'll be back in just a bit for more Poetry in Motion right here on the Ideas Network. Spreading poetry to the masses, making poetry more accessible. Those are some of the ideals that Brian Sonia Wallace worked toward when he hung out his shingle in 2014 to be a poet for hire. Good morning, it's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In June, Brian Sonia Wallace spent a week at Mall of America being its first writer-in-residence. Some days you can find him tucking his typewriter under his arm, heading out on the street to make poetry out of people's everyday lives. He's taking the art of poetry into public spaces, and Brian stays with us. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your favorite poem or your favorite poet? Does it inspire you? Maybe it makes you feel like you're not alone. Tell us about your favorite piece of poetry, 800-642-1234. And let's go to Michelle in Pewaukee. Hi, Michelle, go ahead.
Hi, I was just listening. I was feeling so inspired by this, and it brought me back to remembering that when I was a kid, I actually told my mother I wanted to grow up to be a poet. So I wanted to ask about engaging children, ideas for engaging children in poetry, and particularly like having them try and write poetry or come up with ideas for how to get them involved with poetry.
Brian.
Oh, thank you so much, Michelle. I have to tell you a quick story first. I totally credit me starting to write poetry to my mother, both as a believer in writing and a supporter of writing, but also as someone who would I suspect, sneakily go through and read my journals. And so poetry was a kind of code growing up to say, okay, it's a metaphor, so you're not going to know exactly what's going on. I think poetry is incredible for kids and for young people. My big entree in that, I hate to sound like a broken record, but The Typewriter has been a really interesting piece in doing youth work, and in even with just youth work formally in a school context, but also just with young people who come up to me on the street. Yesterday, I was doing poetry at the LA Public Library, and there were a couple of big groups of high school students who came by and were really intrigued by The Typewriter. And it was such a satisfying interaction because I was writing with my group, Melrose Poetry Bureau, and so we wrote a few of them poems, and as some members were writing, others were reading them poetry and then turning it around and saying, okay, now you read us some. And then we read them what we had written and then turned the typewriters around and had them do the writing exercise Exquisite Corpse, where everyone gets to contribute a line. Mm. And I've done some work in Los Angeles. There's a big immigrant population, particularly with native Spanish speakers. And I've done some work with English language learners. And the idea of being able to have something physical, have something tactile when kids are so used to their touch screens, but to have this sort of industrial machine that physically links them with what they're making has been a huge part of my practice in working with kids and young people on poetry. And then I think beyond that, just the expressive value of that, but I always like to say more than just self-expression, it's communication. It's the old idea that, you know, Emily Dickinson didn't really publish her poems. She wrote them in letters, and then they were published after her death. Mm-hmm. And so poetry is this old art form of, like, do you have something you want to say to someone? Like, maybe try saying it like this.
Well, Michelle, thank you so much for your great questions there. Brian, let's go back to the Mall of America, where you wrote roughly 100 poems over the course of the week for shoppers who would be coming up to you in the mall. We have a couple of these poems. One of them was for Madison. And sometimes people use poetry as a way to experience emotions, to grieve, or to heal. What did you write for someone named Madison?
So this poem, it's a short poem, and it's for a young woman who talked to me, and it was a really heavy day. There are some days where I'm a little bit of a street side unlicensed therapist. And she just had this incredible story about falling in love very young and then losing the person that she had fallen in love with, them passing away. And the idea of kind of how to go on, how to continue experiencing the world with this really early, formative, intense experience. And people quite often have stories of loss. And my strategy in general is not to tell them cheer up or don't cry or it's going to be okay. The strategy is to say, okay, like, what is this place that you're at? What's this thing that you're sitting in? So this was the poem that I wrote for her. Through you, I was remade twice, finding you, losing you. And now I'm older and wiser and broken and mending and remaking myself every day. Thunderclouds and rainbows, but what I know of sun on rainy days, I learned from you. I have traveled now across continents, seen a world, and I know how I fit in it. I will love this place for both of us. I will leave you rainbows everywhere.
Oh, wow. And you brought tears to people's eyes many times.
Yeah, the mall in particular. Some days, writing, everyone is happy and jovial, and some days people, you know, people have things that they need to work out. I mean, it's funny just reading that poem again. I'm like, oh, yes, and sometimes I make myself cry also. But the mall was a really interesting context. At the very beginning of it, I was talking with the sort of social media team for the mall, and they were saying, okay, we want you to track, you know, the number of poems that you write, and what are some other fun metrics? You know, do you want to track the number of steps you take around the mall? And what we ended up tracking was the number of people who cried in response to having a poem written. And it was about a fifth of all people, about 20% of the people that I wrote poems for, ended up having tears in their eyes, which I think is I always credit to the stories that they are willing to share in that space of being brave and being vulnerable, rather than you know, I think I have the easy job in some ways.
Well, and people are willing to open up to you. You're a stranger. They're walking up to you in a mall that's loud. There's a roller coaster, there's Nickelodeon, there's the Lego store. That is a loud place. There's a lot of distractions all around. And you're able to come up with this incredible poetry in the midst of all this chaos.
I think I've been thinking a little bit lately about how it reflects kind of the whole world that we live in, this idea that we're living in a time where there's a lot of noise. I think a lot about the idea that more people are writing today than have ever been writing before, have ever been literate before, and then with social media platforms can actually share that work. And so, you know, 100 years ago, we'd maybe read writing from a few of our closest friends. And today on Facebook, you know, I'm reading writing from all these different people. But because of that, there is so much noise, both literal and kind of conceptual. I think poetry in some ways is a way of paring down and of simplifying and of trying to kind of cut through that.
And you call poetry a currency, but that's not how we use it today. It feels more academic sometimes, how it's taught in schools, perhaps less accessible. Is there something to that?
I think so. I think that we tend to be a society that really values expertise, and there's a huge place in expertise for advancing the craft. But I think that what we've lost a little bit are the, I just love the phrase, the commercial poets, you know, the service poets, the service industry of poetry. You know, it's great that we have the five-star Michelin chefs who are the, you know, who are the waiters of poetry, who are actually bringing the thing to you. And I, when I started doing this, had really limited formal training in poetry. It wasn't what I studied in college. It's something that I had been writing for a long time and reading a lot. But really, I'm playing catch up. I'm still playing catch up in terms of getting to a point where I am in dialogue with poets and in dialogue with the literary establishment, because it ended up being something that I just started. It ended up being something, my background is in theater. And so, you know, in theater, what do you need to have a play? You need an audience. And so it's like, okay, well, how am I going to do this art without immediately having other people to share it with and to see if it's working? So I think I'm approaching things just from a little bit of an oblique angle there.
We're talking right now with full-time poet Brian Sonia Wallace. He is a Los Angeles-based poet for hire. And over the summer, he had a week-long residency at the Mall of America, as people would come up to his table and offer a few words of their life experience, a piece of themselves, and he would write, produce a poem from what they told him. Gathering your thoughts, your questions for Brian, 800-642-1234. Do you write poetry? How do you use poetry in your life? Have you considered becoming a poet for hire? Let's discuss. 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Brian, so once you decided that you were going to do this full time and you started hearing from corporations who wanted you to do these contract work for them, how did you feel about finding this niche to get your poetry into companies and get your poetry into, I guess, the commerce, the business piece of America?
There was a, I want to say it was like a Facebook meme that I saw maybe yesterday that spoke to me a little bit. Or maybe it was an article that said, why can't corporations be the new Medicis? You know, all of this great Renaissance art that we look at had noble patronage or patronage of wealthy families. And we live in a time where, you know, like it or not, a lot of where the money is and a lot of who's deciding what's valuable and what's not are commercial entities. And so I think in some ways, we talked a little bit about my background with grant writing. I think in some ways that really helped me because that's about writing to funders and just helping them see how what you're doing is going to help. And so I really think that we have a little bit of a warped understanding of the arts as charitable giving. You know, it's sort of a charitable thing to support the arts. And I think that really it's about enhancing community. And with companies right now, so many are primarily focused on building a community around their brand. And so it's not about, you know, oh, should we support the arts? It's should the arts support us? Are we building a good community? Are we doing good work that, you know, artists are going to want to come and make rich and vibrant and alive? I think there is always the undercurrent question of sort of, are you selling out? You know, is poetry this this lofty thing? And so is doing this in some way? There was a wonderful comment on the Guardian article that was like, this is debasing poetry. And my response to that was, you know, this is what I'm doing and this is why. If you have a suggestion for something that you would rather I call it than poetry, I'm happy to call it something else. But this is kind of the most concise way that I know of to let people know what I'm doing. I think what I'm doing looks more like poetry than like something else. And there's, I think the idea that art and commerce are really separate things is a relatively new idea. So I think in some ways I'm very old fashioned. In some ways I'm being an originalist about how I'm going about this.
Well, we have a number of people who want to talk with you. Let's go first to Julia in Boyceville. Hi, Julia.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Sure, go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to comment and ask, you know, the poet's opinion about, you mentioned social media, so many people are communicating. There's actually been a lot of changes in the way people use the English language, just grammatically, of course, because we're typing, because we're not as worried about grammar when we communicate on these platforms. And you were communicating in this very, you know, amazing way and using the English language. How do you think that the English language is going to change because we're typing in such a quick fashion? We're communicating so quickly. How are those two things going to come together, do you think, in the future?
Oh, man, that's such an exciting question for me, Julia. I work on a typewriter, so I don't get as much of a chance to play with this as I would like to. But about a year back, I guess, I started really playing with using emoji in my poems, those little smiley faces and icons that you can pull up on your phone. And I think that even just the addition of that keyboard represents a huge, like a seismic shift in the English language, really. All of a sudden, textual communication that it's really hard to get tone from, it's really hard to understand, like is both easier to get tone from and also kind of more fraught. Like, okay, they put an upside down smiley face. Is that a good thing? What does that mean? You know, what is that expression actually? So I think it's kind of uncharted territory in some ways, and it's a way for us to get deeper into empathy and into connecting with people and into, you know, even things like if you're having to read faces in text, you're having to kind of think about what the different facial expressions mean. But at the same time, yeah, it is a really fraught landscape. And I'm a big believer that it's not the substance, it's the dose that separates medicine from poison. So it's something that can be good. It's something that can be bad. I don't have a lot of patience when people are like, oh, man, you know, English is really going downhill. It's like, well, Shakespeare made up half of his words. Like, this is an evolving language, and that's part of why it's such an incredible language for poetry, because we have so many words from so many weird places. In some ways, I think I fit the place of social media and all of these people writing and the new keyboards that we have and, you know, the LOLs and ROTFLs and all of that into that framework.
Julia, thanks for calling in. Let's go to Jim now in Menominee. Hi, Jim. Go ahead.
Hi, Brian. I'm kind of saddened that I missed you at the Mall of America. I'm just about 60 miles to the east, and I would have really enjoyed meeting you. I'm a newspaper guy that goes back about 30 years, and I've been writing for my local newspaper for many years. Most of it is sports, and there's literally poetry in motion. But my question to you is, when you write, is there a specific place that you like to be to get your creative juices flowing? I know I have a certain corner of a certain coffee shop that I like to sit in, and that tends to be where I get my creative juices the best, it seems.
Thank you, Jim. Oh man, favorite place to be is you know, not in direct sun on 100-degree day like this Sunday. I think if given my druthers, I tend to write like horizontally. I tend to be in bed or on a couch with my laptop on top of me, which is not the best for your posture or necessarily for productivity, which is one of the things that I think getting out of the house on the typewriter does for me is it's a practice. It's about forcing yourself to write and have a deadline with people and also to get out of bed.
And Brian, you have to be extremely flexible about your environments for how and where you write your poetry.
I've learned with gigs, if it's an outdoor gig and it goes past, you know, 7 or 8 p.m., I just need to make sure that they have a light or electrical outlets. There's little things that you wouldn't normally think of if you're worried about crafting composition for a poem, but it's like, oh yes, I'm going to be in the grass with the mosquitoes. I think it's cool in a way in that it all makes its way into the poem. And so the different landscapes, you know, even traveling around the country and writing for people in different towns and different cities, you know, is this a place where people's minds are shaped by mountains? Is this a place where people's minds are shaped by prairies? Is this a place where people are near the ocean and that's, you know, part of their psychic landscape? So this idea of how does the outside world inform the inside world is a huge part of that, which is really relevant to Jim's question in a way that I didn't intend, but I'm happy it happened.
Well, Jim, thank you so much for calling in. He was able to create a little literary retreat oasis space somewhere between the Lego store and the Nickelodeon roller coaster. We're talking to Mall of America's first writer in residence this hour, learning about the life of a full-time poet and the projects that keep him employed. Brian Sonia Wallace stays with us. He's a Los Angeles-based poet for hire. He found his niche landing poetry contracts, poetry residencies with corporations like Amtrak, Google and Dollar Shave Club. Bring your questions for Brian, 800-642-1234. Do you write poetry? How do you use poetry in your life? Have you considered being a poet for hire? Join in, 800-642-1234. We'll get back to this conversation in just a moment on the Ideas Network. Brian Sonia Wallace crafted poems on his manual typewriter for Mall of America shoppers who revealed a piece of themselves, intimate details of their lives. In return, they got a poem about what they told him. And here are the metrics, the hard numbers. Over the week-long residency, Brian wrote poems for roughly 100 people. 1 out of 4 people cried, including the person who selected him for this writing contract. And Brian stays with us to discuss poetry in life. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What poems have been your true north? What poems resonate with you? How do you use poetry in your life? 800-642-1234. Let's go to Bruce now in Westfield. Hi, Bruce. Go ahead.
Hi, Brian. I want to thank you for writing poetry. I think it's a great example for young people especially. You've written so many poems for other people. Let's turn the tables just a little. What kind of poem would you need someone to write for you?
Oh, man, Bruce, that is, yeah. One of the nice things about being part of this, having a community of writers, having this poetry collective, Melrose Poetry Bureau, is having people write for you. I've gotten a few poems, relationship poems for my partner, where it's something that I wasn't quite sure how to say, but through talking to a poet was able to kind of give them what they needed to put that into words. That's been really useful. And I think the poem that I would need, I guess, at the moment, is really continuing in the idea of what does bravery look like, not in a kind of machismo, like, oh yeah, we're awesome sense, but in the sense of what is it look like to be able to be vulnerable and hold space and have that be okay. That's the continuing question, I guess.
Well, Bruce,
thank you for that.
Yeah, thank you for turning the tables there a little bit. That was fun. And others can join in, 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Brian, we know that you have a theater background and your knowledge of poetry is an evolving thing, and I'm sure for all poets it's evolving. But when you go to read poetry, what do you read?
In terms of poets that I'm in dialogue with?
Poets, right. Well, poets that that you find are helpful in your craft, what you do in the day-to-day, and poets that are perhaps expanding your horizon and helping you in your work.
Absolutely. I come back to T.S. Eliot and Ginsberg a lot, Ralph Waldo Emerson and Thoreau. Not necessarily traditional poets, but I feel like a lot of the transcendentalists' writing is kind of essay poetry middle ground. There's a contemporary slam poet named Denise Mojgani, who I look at a lot for not just his writing, but also his performance and the idea of how do you create a reading that has sort of a transcendent quality. It's something that, you know, can touch on real themes, can touch on things that are going on in the world, but at the same time is able to have not just elevated language, but a little bit of a sense of kind of what are we reaching toward? What is the intangible that we're trying to grasp? And then I've been really trying to kind of sink into the contemporary poetry scene, particularly in Los Angeles, and reading what friends are writing, and reading what this has been the funniest source is like reading what people have been sharing over social media. And one of the cool things about starting to get kind of involved with more of the poetry community is that pretty much every time I go on social media, there are poems popping up on my newsfeed. And so there's a little bit of daily reading. Poets.org also does a poem a day if you sign up for a mailing list, and they send a mix of contemporary and more classic poems. And that's been a really good thing to just remind myself. You know, it doesn't take a lot of time to read a poem every day, but like anything, you have to make a practice of it. Otherwise, you get a month in and go, oh, oops.
It falls by the wayside, right?
Exactly.
Let's go to Lyric now in Blanchardville with a question. Hi, Lyric.
Hi. Oh, thank you very much, Brian. This is very moving, and thank you for the program. I've been attending these community meals on Wednesday evenings in Dodgeville. They're wonderful, where different churches come in and cook. And there's usually about 100 to 150 people, and there's usually 20 high schoolers or so. And I like it because it's such a diverse group of all kinds of areas. And I put together a game that I used with the children when they sit around the table, and I brought in maybe 100 or 200 words on cardstock on little pieces of paper, and then gave them blank pieces of paper and asked them to write down 5 words that they liked the sound of or words that meant something to them. And then they could pull 5 words from the pile, not knowing what the words were, and they'd rearrange them on the table interactively kind of as a group, and then they came up with these beautiful, beautiful poems. And I just wanted them to have a way to voice some of their feelings. Some of the children are dreamers and people of all kinds of age groups. And so this is so meaningful to hear you talk about you working in the Mall of America, and your poems are just wonderful.
Oh, thank you so much, Lyric. I love the idea. It's like you're doing fridge magnet poetry, but having them create the words and create the surface. That's super cool.
That is really cool. And there are a lot of different ways that you can make this writing more approachable, especially if you have perhaps a fear of writing or a fear of where do I start with this first line of a poem.
Mm-hmm. One of the things, as Lyric was talking, that I was remembering is one of the exercises that I like to do if I am teaching a workshop, really regardless of age group, to get people remembering that that poetry can be just a tool in conversation rather than something that you have to go away and think about and be really scared of. And so when I do introductions for workshops, I ask people to tell the group their name and how their week was, but as a metaphor. So my week was the thunder on top of mountains, or my week was wearing a scuba outfit underwater and it starts leaking. I love, my favorite so far was this little girl. She was maybe 10, and she said, "My week has been like a burnt tortilla." I'm just like, yes, like, you are poets. Now you know you can do it. Now write that down. And then that's what this is. That's all it is.
That's great. Lyric, thanks so much for calling in. Let's go to Mike now in Hancock. Hi, Mike. Go ahead.
Good morning. I taught creative writing for a number of years, about 30, and I was better at assigning stuff than doing it myself. But I have started to write some poems, and I just love what Brian's doing. And I thought maybe I would share a poem that is more entertaining than instructive. But
please do.
Okay, it's entitled Frog Lust. Go to the musk of croaking frogs who copulate on soaking logs. Their slippery legs are pumping eggs whose yolks turn into polywogs, who swim beneath the sun-warm scum, waiting for their legs to come so they can crawl up on the logs and live a froggy life of lust. And copulate, as all frogs must.
Oh,
you never know.
Like, yeah, thank you. I can't say that I've ever started a morning with a poem about frog sex before, but I am quite happy to today.
You never know on Wisconsin Public Radio, you know?
Oh, man, I love the image. I love the image of swimming under the scum. That's so evocative and so visceral.
Well, Mike, you know, keep writing. I mean, Brian, what would you tell Mike? Because here he has assigned poetry to others, and perhaps he needs a push.
I mean, Mike's been teaching creative writing for 30 years. I don't know what I can tell him, except I think my push is always share the work, you know? Don't be embarrassed. I think there's something really vulnerable about giving work away. But that poem definitely made me smile. And, you know, who are the people who need to smile, who maybe could hear that? You know, is there a coffee shop that, like, needs that poem up on their bulletin? Like, there are little ways, I feel like, to just get work living in public and with people that I think are so important. Because, I mean, we, at the very beginning of the hour, talked about the idea of dialogue. You know, what is good conversation?
Right.
And it has to have two people.
Mm. Yeah. So as we wrap up here, Brian, do you expose yourself with these poems as you hand them over from your typewriter each and every day you do this? Do you ever feel like you too are being changed in some way? And we're drawing close here. We've got about 15 seconds left or so.
Summarize your personal transformation.
Yeah, exactly. Go.
Of course. I mean, it's always an evolving process. I'm in the third year of doing this, so in some ways I'm still new to it, and I'm really fascinated as I continue to write, and the idea of, you know, how do you poem America? I think really what I'm doing is I'm getting an insight into so many people's lives that most people don't have access to, and that's got to change you just in terms of capacity for empathy and having a little bit of a sense of what's going on with people in the world.
Well, Brian, what a pleasure. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure, Kate. Thank you so much.
That was Brian Sonia Wallace. He is a California-based poet for hire, the author of I Sold These Poems, Now I Want Them Back. The summer he was a writer in residence at the Mall of America, where he wrote poems for strangers, and he recently wrote about this experience in The Guardian. This hour of the morning show was produced by Keely Baltina and Nyasia Ellison. Michelle Johnson is executive producer. I'm Kate Archer Kent, and it's Pure Poetry here on the Ideas Network.